Sunny Kelly from Tom Walz's lab at Harvard. And she's going to talk about monolayer purification for single particle EM. And I think she focused on this at the Gordon Conference this summer.
Yeah. So, and people liked it so much they wanted to hear it again. But with a different spin. So as I get this started, I first started working with monolayer samples in Ken Taylor's lab for my PhD. And when I joined Tom's lab a few years ago, we wanted to do things with 2D crystals, and it kind of led into single particles and just sort of evolved over the last year or so into what it's become today. So I'd like to thank Bridget and Clinton and Ron for the opportunity to come and present our work today. Okay, so the technique we've been developing in Tom's lab is monolayer purification for a single particle electron microscopy. And historically, what was first done back in the 80s was a technique in Kornberg's lab in which people were using lipid monolayers. Where's the... using lipid monolayers as a means to try and concentrate and create 2D crystals out of soluble proteins in the aqueous phase. So what we see here is a picture in which we have an aqueous phase containing protein in a well of a, potentially a Teflon block, and you put a lipid phase over top of it, and the protein migrates toward the monolayer and tends to concentrate and allow you to make, under the proper conditions of buffer, et cetera, you know, a 2D array. And so this 2D array can then be imaged in an electron microscope to try and get structural information. The technique was then done on using positively charged lipid monolayers to look at RNA polymerase. And then one of the largest specimens examined that I could find in the literature was the 50S ribosomal subunit. And eventually, Liz Kublak did some very innovative work using nickel and TA lipid monolayers, in which she actually crystallized the HISTAG HIV-1 reverse transcriptase. And that was actually groundbreaking work, because it introduced the use of using nickel and TA groups into the monolayer specimens. So currently in the literature, what we see is there are about 90 projection maps in negative stain and cryo-EM using monolayer samples, only 15 of which have been done in cryo, and even less, I mean, only 7 cryo-EM reconstructions exist in 3D. So there's like a big gap between why there are so many projection maps and so little work done in 3D and cryo-EM. And I believe most of these were done in Ken's group. I did one of these for my PhD. But there are limitations, obviously, either in the computing of these specimens or actually in the specimens themselves that prevent us from going to, number one, high resolution and from actually getting good 3D information, but yet we can get great projection map information. So we wanted to kind of address these issues initially in my work with Tom. And then we started to use it for single particles. So some of the drawbacks, actually, in doing 2D crystals in the monolayer specimen are the fact that you have to screen conditions, which is probably the most time-consuming point of producing 2D crystals. There's a very fragile transfer step when you have to actually transfer the monolayer sample to the EM grid. The main issue in probably achieving higher resolution is the specimen flatness. We heard a very elegant work this morning by Yoshi on how flatness is extremely important in getting to higher resolution. I think with the wavy monolayer, in which the lipid is actually contacting the grid, that's killing us every time to try and get to higher resolution. So we actually thought, Tom was doing a lot of single particle work at the time, that an alternative approach to try and get around some of these issues is to just look at single particles in the electron microscope. But to use what was currently done in the literature with the nickel and TA monolayer stuff to not only create a nice specimen for looking at single particles in the microscope, but a dual goal could be to actually use it as a purification technique. Since there's nickel and TA in the monolayer, why not just use this as an affinity matrix by which you could add a messy sample, cell lysate, et cetera, pull out a purified sample, and have a nice single particle specimen for the monolayer, not being killed by specimen flatness that's invoked by 2D crystal specimen. So what I'm going to talk about today is actually the development of the nickel monolayer system as a purification method. And Tom, in his research talk, is going to address what we actually did to get the 3D reconstructions and applying that to a real system, which we actually had much success with recently. So, in general, these are all the details in which that I use in doing monolayer purification. We start with the protein sample being added to a well of the wells of a Teflon block. These blocks hold about 25 microliters to sample. And what we use is cell lysates with a target protein of interest. The target protein of interest naturally has to have a his tag so that it binds to the monolayer surface that contains the nickel and Ta group. And the buffer I use in general to start with is just heapies with a bit of salt and imidazole, depending on what the type of cell lysate I'm starting with. So you have cell lysate, you're overexpressing a protein, you can pull out your complexes directly onto the monolayer if you can suppress the background with imidazole and actually make a nice sample. So the second step, once you have your sample in the block, is to actually add the monolayer over top. And the way we mix our monolayers is that I use a filler lipid of either a saturated lipid of DLPC, which is a C12 lipid, or a C14 lipid, DMPC, to which I add nickel and Ta lipid. And I reconstitute powder of these, each to 1 mg/mL in chloroform, and then add appropriate mixtures of the nickel and Ta group into the hole, into a tube, actually, and then cast it over top. I apply 1 microliter of this mixture to the top of the aqueous phase here, and at the air-water interface is where our protein of interest, our histag proteins, actually bind to the monolayer containing the nickel and Ta. And after appropriate incubation time, at either 4 degrees Celsius or at room temperature, we can actually add an EM grid on top of the monolayer, and we're able to sample this in the electron microscope. So what I'm going to actually do is break down each of these steps and describe them in a bit more detail through the rest of my talk in a more practical sense and how we're able to visualize these using cryo-EM. So basic considerations are the biological sample preparation, how we're making our cell lysates, what we're doing special that we can actually use as input into being purified onto the monolayer. How we're preparing our grids. We don't do anything as extensive as is done at Scripps. We're kind of quick and dirty about it, but I'll tell you the extent of which I've noticed things have to be done. Different ways in which we can transfer the fragile specimen to the EM grid, and I use Holy grids for this, actually. I use the quantifold grids. We screen the samples and negative stain once they're on the grid, and then we can vitrify them. Then we do low-dose imaging to actually try and collect data. So what I do for my cell extracts is I either grow SF9 cells, I use bacteria, or mammalian cells, in which you can grow your complex of interest containing a histag. I mean, there's nothing special about that. It's just how you overexpress generically any other protein. But once you have the protein actually being expressed, your histag construct within the cells, you can just lyse them. I use lysozyme and sonication at 4 degrees. And then spin down the cell debris to obtain cleared cell lysate. If I'm doing mammalian cells, actually the lady in the lab who was helping with this was doing everything in the mammalian cells. I was doing mostly the bacteria. And this can also be done in SF9 cells. But you can also use a secreted protein that gets secreted out of the cells and into the media and purify from that more directly. I mean, you actually have a cleaner background than using a cell lysate. So we lyse the cells, spin down the debris. Then this can be used directly as the input into the monolayer with a little bit of buffering and imidazole. This is very simple how I clean my grids. I don't have these fancy devices, but I learned this in kids' lab. So the monolayer is hydrophobic, and we're going to put a grid on top of it. We want a hydrophobic interaction between the lipid and the grid. So we actually want hydrophobic grids so that you have a compatible surface. We don't want hydrophilic grids for this process. So quantifold grids sometimes might have plastic residue still on them. So the way we clean those, I learned this from Diane Taylor, is that we just put the quantifold grids with the grid bar side down, the rough side that Joel just showed in his images, on top of filter paper that's saturated with ethyl acetate, and put the lid over top of the dish. This is in like just a generic glass Petri dish. And leave that in a hood overnight, and it cleans off all the plastic residue. And if I'm having issues with pickup, I can make the grids more hydrophobic if I just bake them at 100 degrees C for at least an hour. And I don't really know exactly what that does to the molecular mechanism of the carbon, but I know it dries off the moisture to the effect that I can have a little bit of a better pickup if I'm not having really a good day in terms of humidity. So there are two transfer methods that I think are basically described with success in the literature. The first one is a direct transfer method that I was just talking about, where you put the grid directly over top of the lipid layer and you have this hydrophobic interaction. And let's say, in this case, I'm talking about 2D crystals. Mostly we did a lot of troubleshooting with 2D crystals and then applied the techniques to single particles. So with the direct transfer technique, you just simply place the grid over top, then you lift the grid off perpendicular to the surface of the aqueous phase so that the lipid layer sticks. And in this example, your 2D crystal is then attached to the grid. The other technique that... Yes?
What's on the grid? Is it continuous carbon film?
It's wholly carbon film, quantifold 2-1 grids with 2-micron holes and 1-micron spacing of carbon in between. So in this case, I'm actually going to talk a little about continuous carbon grids, though. But I'm going to take a quick diversion and talk about the loop transfer method, which is also described in the literature, which hasn't had nearly as much utilization as I think the direct transfer method, but might have potential when working with 2D crystals. So in the loop transfer method, you actually take a wire loop, like we use a platinum loop of, I think, about 3.5 millimeters in diameter. And you could take and just touch this down on top of the monolayer and then add this, or then touch the continuous carbon grid with this, such that you get an interaction between a 2D array and the continuous carbon, which is a much more robust interaction than is with this hydrophobic effect, we think. So we were actually trying to go for 2D crystals at this point and make 2D crystals of better resolution. And we thought that if we could actually attach just the protein to the grid and with the loop, that we might have some success. And I'm diverting off from single particles at this point, but yes.
So after you transfer using the wire transfer on the grid,
yeah.
How did you remove the wire?
I just lift, and the sample's there. Yeah, protein is there. The grid is glow discharged in this case. The grid is not glow discharged in this case. So here we want hydro. In this case, we want hydrophilic. In this case, we want hydrophobic. Yes. No. This is when I was trying to make 2D crystals, but I thought it was interesting, and the audience would appreciate the technical differences and subtleties in doing the different transfer methods. So I was just going to mention quickly a comparison of looking at direct transfer versus loop transfer. So here we used as a test specimen from a student at MIT an SLR protein, and this particular SLR protein had only been determined to 20 angstroms historically. It's from it's an SBPA SLR protein. And so we can see in the direct transfer versus the loop transfer method for 2D crystals that diffraction is quite similar. So there's not a real difference in the wholly carbon grids between the two methods. But if we start to examine and try to use some tricks to get better 2D crystals using different methodologies of transfer, we basically shot different images of different ways to actually transfer the monolayers to the grid. And if we look at the resolution bins, that the direct transfer in ethane gave the worst resolution, whereas the loop transfer in ethane was slightly better. We then tried to embed the 2D crystals in trehalose, and that was a modest improvement. But we got a huge improvement when we embedded in trehalose and then froze into ethane. So what this tells us is there is a more, or what we think is going on, is there's a more robust interaction when we glow discharge the grid and add 2D crystals with the loop, back inject trehalose and then plunge into ethane, such that the 20 angstrom crystal that never progressed in the literature went immediately to 7 angstrom. And we were quite encouraged by that because we could actually start to see question whether this is the domain organization or this is the domain organization, which was actually thought to exists in the literature. And the student who is actually working on this with me has decided to take this up using single particles to see if she can actually discern between the two of those. So sugar embedding on continuous carbon and freezing into ethane proved to be quite promising for 2D arrays. But when we went to tilt these, still we could not get beyond 15 angstrom because some inherent issue of flatness we suspected. So we went back to single particles and found that just the simple direct transfer ethane method for single particles and avoiding sugar because of the artifacts that might occur when you're actually visualizing that in the image seemed to be the best. So although we had great promise with the trehalose embedding in the ethane, which we would like to still continue to work on, it's not really at the level at which we could get crystals to higher resolution. So we're actually still working on this from a single particle perspective, in which we're actually doing the purification scheme. So I've talked a little about the basic sample preparation. You prepare a whole cell lysate just generically as you would any other expressed protein. You clean your grids, and then you transfer it. For single particles, you use the direct transfer method, freezing into ethane. And for 2D arrays, it seems to be continuous carbon with loop transfer, materialist embedding is best. So negative stain screening, we always look at things in negative stain first before we freeze, and we determine what's going on. So we did this using a transferrin receptor complex just natively to see if we could actually determine if the monolayer is good enough to recruit the complex contain a histag. We cloned a histag into the N-terminus here. So we could test the monolayer to see if we could pull out single particles from lysates. So this is the initial screening we did was in negative stain. And the way we do that is we just pick it up using the direct transfer method. There's always a 3 microliter aqueous phase that comes along with the sample. I've measured it several times. It seems to be very consistently 3 microliters. So if you have a sample that always has a consistent volume, that's really good for freezing because it eliminates variability in which you can do your freezing in the I use a VitroBot now or your manual freezing. So back to negative staining though, you remove the aqueous phase and you add the negative stain. Your sample's embedded in the negative stain. Then you can just simply examine it in the electron microscope like you would any other specimen. So when I spoke at the Gordon conference about this a little bit, questions of fluidity, segregation, this kind of thing came up. So I actually went back and explored this a little bit since then. And using different percentages of nickel and TA with different filler lipids that are at different phase transitions, I used DLPC, which is a very fluid lipid at room temperature, versus DLPC at 4 degrees, which is a little less fluid but still enough fluidity to crystallize upon. Versus DMPC, which is actually in its gel phase at 4 degrees Celsius. And what we can see using the transferrin receptor complex is that we get a nice distribution of particles in every case, but quite rapidly at room temperature, things really start to clump together and form quickly, whereas if the sample is actually more in its gel phase, you get a nicer distribution of particles. But you have to go all the way up to 40% nickel and TA. So, I mean, it makes it more problematic if you're trying to do cryo if you have so few particles. But these two conditions seem to be optimal just in the negative stain if you want to get something out of negative staining. Whereas this condition, even though it's more crowded, actually seem to be optimal because you have 10 times potentially more particles here using 20% nickel and TA as you would 2% nickel and TA. So basically I stuck with this condition for using negative staining in this condition for using cryo-EM. And so back to the purification scheme, what we can see is just in solution from a SF9 lysate to which we've added our transferrin receptor complex at very low nanogram concentrations, we see a mess. Like this is what a whole cell lysate looks like on a grid, containing very little of our histag protein. But when we add this as our input to our nickel and TA monolayer, with only 2% of the nickel and TA into the monolayer, we can actually start to see the particles with still plenty of background that doesn't convince you that it's pure. But upon the input of adding 50 millimolar imidazole actually to the same sample, so we take the sample, add 50 millimolar imidazole on the nickel and TA monolayer, we get this, actually. So this gives us quite encouraging information that this is a way in which we can quickly purify things from this to this. I want to say that we're able to pull out as little as 10 nanograms of the transferrin receptor complex from a whole cell lysate containing an upwards of about 7 mg per mil total protein. This was good enough to actually just do a random conical tilt 3D reconstruction, at 120 kV, nothing too fancy, but I just collected tilt pairs to actually see if I could get a random conical tilt or a nice 3D density from random conical tilt method. And it actually shows us that we're missing a bit of density here, but it's not so bad as initial model. This shows that we can actually have a self-consistent method with fixed orientations and negative staining enough to get an initial model to which we can add our cryo-EM particles and use a more common line-based approach. So if you use a negative staining, you get a nice initial model. You would get an even nicer one if you did cryo-negative staining because you would probably most likely fill into these a little bit. So cryo-negative is probably the best way to go. But I haven't really experimented with that much. I just wanted to see if the method would work. So we got a pretty decent reconstruction of it. And I later did cryo-EM on this. And Tom's going to talk about the results of that, actually, which looks much better in this. It's actually very fixed, very much around, because of the drying process superimposed by the grid onto the sample. It's pretty fixed. It's not so variant. Tom has an image of that, actually, in his talk. He's going to talk about the differences as well and the distribution between the ice and negative staining, but the ice is much better. actually. We think the drying actually just forces it upon the grid. So now that we have something that's usable in negative stain, we can actually advance to vitrifying our specimen. So that's exactly what I did. I took the same input as I showed previously, and I placed the grid bar side down, meaning the rough side that Joel was talking about is what I placed directly onto the specimen. And I picked that up then with forceps, as I said earlier, perpendicularly to the plane of the monolayer. And I blot off the 3 microliter subphase and plunge into ethane. And I actually do this on a VitroBot now. I did the 2D crystals in manual freezing. I'd always done manual freezing before coming to Tom's lab. But he had this VitroBot, and he says, oh, this might make it easy. Try it. And it did. It works. You just add your, you load your sample on, you tell it to start process, and it freezes quite nicely. So this is actually an image that I took from a paper we with Ken, actually. And this is how the orientation of the drop is relative to the grid. And this is the blotting step coming from the backside. We add the sample to the backside, and it goes up and into the hole. And then we blot from the backside with the idea that the grid bar can help prevent you from blotting the specimen off of the grid. Plus, the specimen is fixed to the monolayer, which allows you to blot away enough of the aqueous phase that you get a very, very nice, thin specimen really nicely distributed onto the grid. So a few of the differences in the manual and the automated freezing procedures are that the manual is more of an uncontrolled environment unless you have a special manual freezing device with a case around it. You would have to actually calibrate the volume that you have of your drop of your specimen with your blotting time. But you get very consistent ice over the entire grid. Consistent being could be consistently too thick or consistently too thin, but if you get just the right specimen, you're set. You have a beautiful grid. Whereas freezing on the VitroBot, I have a more controlled environment. I try to set the conditions at 22 degrees at 65% relative humidity. And the blotting time I found to be proportional to the volume on the grid. I don't know if this is the case with everyone's VitroBot, but 2 seconds for 2 microliters, 3 seconds for 3 microliters. So I know my specimen always has the same subphase. I set it 3 seconds, and every grid I look at is potentially usable and actually has been usable since we were able to establish the method. And we get a nice gradient of vitreous ice across the grid. And I think that's actually one of the best things about the FEI device is that some areas are very thick, some maybe thinner, and some are really, really thin. But you have plenty to choose from in which you can collect easily 3 boxes of film from one entire grid. The conditions I use in the electron microscope are pretty generic. I think they're pretty similar to what a lot of people are using. We use an F20 at 200 kV for single particles, and I use the 2-1 grids. As I said earlier, a 50K mag with a pretty reasonable defocus and under low dose conditions. Then we scan those we scan the film actually that we develop using a Zeiss scanner, and then we bend everything down by 3. So we end up with about a 4 angstrom sampling at the specimen level, or you could bend by less, you know, whatever. So this is what we end up with when we look at the cryo sample. So this is the same input slide that I showed before containing the cell lysate. And with the 2% nickel NTA in the monolayer, we end up with very few particles, similar to what we saw in negative stain, but even less. We think that some particles might be shearing off during the plunging process, actually when the sample is being plunged into the ethane. So if we actually use the 20% nickel NTA into the monolayer, we get a nice distribution of particles, some of which appear to be a bit aggregate, or not aggregate, but segregated somewhat together, but plenty of which you can pick from one grid square. I mean, you get tons of particles, and you can start with very, very small quantities from a very dirty sample, which I think is a huge advantage. So one of the last things I did in Ken's lab was we thought it would be kind of cool, Legendon was just coming around, to do a Legendon run on a monolayer crystal. So this is the first monolayer specimen that that was looked at using Legendon, which is out now in press. And we can see the entire grid. Some of it looks great, some of it is not so great, but across one whole grid square you have very, very good continuous ice. And it's very homogeneous. So most of the sample is actually very, very good. And if you screen this with 2D crystals, you know that your specimen is good because you get a direct readout of the fact that the FFT of the, you know, is good in the hole. So we were able to assess exactly how much of the sample would be good in a cryo-EM specimen using lipid monolayers this way. And it turns out if you look at the radiodensity function across the different types of holes, you get some very thin areas, as I said, some that are a little bit thicker. And the way we can tell is that if you see this little mark here, it's not very obvious to us, but a computer can pick it out, that if you stick in the range of this type of ice thickness, you're in a pretty good operating range. If you have very, very big particles, you maybe want a little bit thicker ice, and thinner particles, you probably want a little thinner ice, but you get information across the entire hole. Or actually, we got the 2D crystals across the entire hole, and I observe that to be the same thing when I look at my monolayer samples of single particles, which is really encouraging to the fact that there were about, from what we could estimate just from this one Legendon run, 28,000 holes that actually had crystals in it. This was of an alpha actinin specimen. And if you get a measly 200 particles per hole, which is really easy to accomplish using the monolayer purification technique, each grid would potentially have between 5 and 8 million particles that you could actually run overnight or however long it takes to collect and get a full data set just from one monolayer sample. I mean, I know that seems really ambitious and maybe this number is off, but the potential is actually there to get a full data set. I mean, people have done it with other specimens, but this is doing it from a crude specimen to which you just add imidazole. So I think that that's actually very encouraging, that the method has potential to work for the monolayer purification technique as well. So this is my high throughput plug. I think high throughput is a great means in the future, and the way that some things certainly should be done, and maybe some other things shouldn't be done that way, but I'm all in favor of doing these high throughput things, because instead of investing so much time on one problem, you can address a lot of problems and actually make more of a biological impact. So this is how I see that we can grow constructs now. It's just in a six-well plate. What I did was I went online and I found a company in Germany that has cloned lots and lots of human proteins into histag vectors. So you could just order your clone from the company, grow it up in E. coli, and then address whatever you want to look at, which is what I did. So I grew up 100 mL test expression of bacteria using one ribosomal subunit of the large, the 50S, well, it was actually a human RPL3 subunit, which is homologous to the RPLC subunit in bacteria. So I overexpressed this in bacteria and used this as input into the monolayer purification scheme. And what we got out were very pure 50S ribosomal particles in less than 20 minutes from a whole cell lysate of a test expression. And as I said, we expressed 100 milliliters. In the entire project, I used less than a mil, and we already have a 3D reconstruction of the 50S ribosome in ice just as a test specimen. So I think there's great potential there that in the future we could just, you know, examine whatever clone you want, buy whatever clone you want, grow it up even in six-well plates, and immediately within 20 minutes you can end up with a cryo-EM specimen if everything's working right with the procedure. I mean, there's still room for improvement, but I think the potential is actually there, which we can address a lot more things in a much more expedient fashion. So currently what I'm interested in, Tom Saab does really amazing work with membrane proteins. So we'd like to see if we can adapt this method to actually look at single particles of membrane proteins, and also not just limiting ourselves to histag constructs, but there are like tons of other amazing libraries available out there in yeast and in other organisms. So we want to actually see if we can adapt the method to be used with other tags, as well as membrane proteins. And something I think is very interesting is that we can actually start to make 3D reconstructions of these native complexes that we're able to capture from these cell lysates in very rapid time. So we would actually need large data sets because of all the variability of the native complexes that would exist. And in doing so, we would use automated routines to collect such large data sets. So Daniela Dukovsky is really wonderful. She did the work in cloning the transferrin receptor complex in 293 T cells and helped with troubleshooting a lot of things. And all the work was done in the lab of Tom Walls at HMS. So again, thanks to the organizers. If you guys have any questions, be happy to answer them.
Mm-hmm.
So you would take a grid that's perfectly prepare for single particles, knock it off, and then make another single particle grid with it?
Or
are you talking about just in general to purify things?
Just in general.
Yeah, you can do that, because to prove that we had what we thought we had to elute this with like 200 millimolar metazole from the grid and successive drops and then mass spec it. So you can easily, once it's on the grid, still elute it off because of this interaction if you keep it in its liquid phase. Yeah, you can do that. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah, that was what I thought. Yeah, they are on an undulating lipid layer. I've only done and had success with direct transfer. I saw, like I said, the loop to be most beneficial in doing the 2D arrays. I kind of thought that if I did the loop transfer for the single particles, it might be that even if there's a small bit of contamination still from the lysate into the drop that's being blot off upon the freezing process, I might actually see that if I do a loop transfer and it wouldn't be as pure. So potentially I thought it might run into a little danger that way. And the direct transfer seemed to work, so I never went back and actually physically tried to demonstrate with loop transfer that that might make a better specimen. And we actually saw that when we did this in cryo, that the undulation and deformations caused by the lipid contact with the monolayer actually helps to get different orientations of the particle with respect to the monolayer in the ice. So we actually thought it might be to our benefit that it's not flat and it's a bit wavy for single particle work, whereas I think it may be killing us every time we try to do better resolution work in 2D arrays. Yeah, Mark? That's one route to go, and another route is to try lots of different things, which I'm kind of in the process of doing and need to really try and figure out when I get back. But the disadvantage of that is that fluorinated lipids aren't commercially available for everyone to use. So I want to make it available as a general technique that others can use and not have some sort of strange proprietary ride on it, you know. But that's been demonstrated in the literature, and people have done that before for 2D crystals and worked beautifully. If they were available, I would think that would be an obvious choice to start with. Yeah, so I'm going to have to work on a few things when I get back, which I think that's the best part of my job, is that I get to actually play with these things and work these things out, and hopefully I'm up for the challenge. Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. That was one of Tom's points too. Exactly. You can pull it out very, very quickly in around 20 minutes or so. That was one of Tom's ideas, exactly, that we're interested in all these really dynamic biological processes. By the time you go through days or several hours even of purification, things can be breaking down, subunits falling off. Who knows what's going on? If you have a very quick, rapid method that purifies as well as embeds your sample, for cryo-EM and structure determination, may be a huge advantage to getting a full complex of what you're actually generally interested in biologically. Yeah.
So you're planning to try if that works instead of complex that nobody can isolate?
Yeah, we have plans to extend this to different people at the med school who have very interesting projects and things they want to work on. I was just establishing the method. Now we know it works. We're going to apply it as much as we can to preparing specimen in the future. It's exactly what would be one of the huge benefits of it, I think. That was Tom's idea to try, actually, yeah. Yes? Yeah. They have several hundreds of proteins. It was like some German guy's PhD project to make a histag library. And fortunately, I Googled a histag library, you know, and found it. And they sell these clones to anyone who wants it. I mean, I just bought a couple of them and gave it a try, and it worked nicely. And they give you information on test expressions and all these sort of things. I just found one that I thought would be compatible with the ribosome that's not easily falling off, that's in a fixed position, that we could actually test the method with from, like, a lysate. But I have information on that company if anyone is interested. I think it's RPZD is the name of the company. Even if you Google histag protein libraries, you'll find it for sure. It's, how big? Yeah, I'm not really sure exactly. This subunit that I used was only 46 kd. But if you're interested in complexes, you really possibly only need a tag on one subunit of it. And you could possibly tag other subunits, you know, to isolate different states and such. I'm not exactly sure. I'd have to go back and look on the website, like, how big of a protein that is actually available. But it's a human library, so I would imagine things that can be expressed in E. coli. But I think they might have extended this to other expression systems as well, so they may have bigger proteins available.
Well. All right, how about keep questions? Sometimes we have to take what I suggest is a 10-minute break before the panel. And how about one more question?
Make it a good one.
Who's got the best one? All right, go ahead, Bob.
Okay, Bob, sure.
I would like to ask you to just kind of summarize and repeat about the efficiency. What fraction of the EM grids that you make do you find useful? And contrasting the loop method with the the touch and pickup.
Is
100%, 5%?
So I would say now that the method is established, I would say close to 100% of the grids are useful in cryo-EM. I haven't had a bad grid in a really long time using the method for single particles. For doing the loop transfer, it depends on how good your crystal is. So you want to know, like, what's
the single particle.
Okay, I haven't done loop transfer on single particles, so I can't really speak to that.
So it won't be worse than the crystals, I guess, but I don't know. Okay.
Yeah, I haven't done much with the loop. I was doing that as a means to try and get a better crystal. But I think that all the grids under the conditions that I'm making them now with the freezing conditions set up on the VitroBot, the 3-second blotting with the percent humidity and the gradient that's imposed upon the freezing with the nature of the VitroBot, they're all usable at this point.
Okay, I think we should stop here.